with the top of a glass, then placing the bread in a frying pan and cracking the egg into the center. Dick would wander in and out, usually in some long underwear, preparing a roast, some confection, and a huge boiling pot full of anything else lying around the kitchen. Neither Kate nor Dick ever trespassed to the other side of the kitchen, except at night, when she'd checked to see that he'd turned off all the burners on the stove. "One day he's going to blow this house up," she'd say, on the one out of four times she'd find a flame still burning. The rest of us were always encouraged to hunt and gather from his sector. A turkey drumstick or a slice of cake is an appetizer to the meal being prepared on Kate's side of the kitchen. The unspoken rivalry between Dick and Kate stretched as far back as childhood and increased as her fame grew. Any hope of restoring balance in their relationship was lost forever when in the early 40s Dick wrote a play about a multimillionaire courting an actress. While it was clearly written as farce, it was plainly based on Howard Hughes and Kate. She resented the intrusion, and the entire family stood behind her. Dick claimed that it contained some of his best writing and that he intended to get the play produced. Only after all the Hepburns came down on him did he back off. In doing so, he had established a foundation of resentment toward his sister, one sound enough to make her feel responsible for his livelihood. That he was never too proud to accept her charity only furthered his resentment. One weekend, Dick gave me one of his later plays to read, a work that periodically caught the eye of a producer. It was a witty account of an eccentric New England family that made me see he could have had a playwriting career had he actively pursued it. "The theater is tough," Kate said, accepting only a small measure of responsibility for standing in his way. "But that play about Howard and me was cheap exploitation and would not have made his career. It would have been a stunt. If Dick really wanted the career thing badly enough, he should have written another play just as good, and another one after that." He never did. While privacy among the Hepburns was, of course, held in high regard, one afternoon I came into my room and found Kate rifling through my overnight bag. I had clearly caught her red-handed. All she could do was smile sheepishly, for a moment. "Did you find anything interesting?" I asked. "No," she said, stuffing my clothes and some papers back into the bag. "Not a goddamned thing." Except for a box of chocolates, from which she took a piece of almond bark, which she ate as she walked out the door. There were lots of rules at Fenwick, but they were changed as often as they were broken. One day we were preparing a big fruit salad, and while peeling apples, I dropped a piece on the floor. I picked it up to throw it in the garbage, and Kate yelled, "What are you doing? It's perfectly fine." Without even washing it, she threw it into the bowl. "Oh, yes," Phyllis added. "My father used to say a man eats a peck of dirt before he dies." A few weeks later, I lost my grip on a carrot, and against my better judgment, I tossed it into the bowl. "Oh, my God," Kate shrieked. "Do you think we are animals around here?" She fished it out of the bowl and chucked it into the garbage along with several leaves of lettuce she felt I had also contaminated. "What about the peck of dirt a man eats before he dies?" I asked. "Oh," said Kate, "that's one of those utterly ridiculous English expressions." Every week there was a new policy regarding bed linens, as I prepared to change mine every Sunday morning. Sometimes she'd insist I leave the sheets on until my next visit. Other times she'd declare, "We change all the sheets in this house every few days." She often expressed strong sentiments against anything but white sheets, but periodically light blue would appear on my bed. In any case, Kate almost always took part in making the bed, and I never saw anybody derive as much pleasure from a good hospital corner as she did. Sunday after lunch brought the most dreaded moment in the week. That was when we packed the car for the drive back to the city, the hour in which all passengers and their baggage, as well as all perishable foodstuff and all living cut flowers, were packed into the white sedan. Even with her worsening foot, Kate would tear from room to room, gathering a shirt and a pair of shoes from one bedroom, bouquets of huge lilies and tall stems of Queen Anne's lace from the living room, jars of peg-stewed peaches and leftover zucchini soup, wheels of cheese, tins of cookies, loaves of bread, and coolers of meats and fruits and vegetables from the kitchen. Meantime, food was being prepared for the drive down. Deviled eggs, heavy on the cayenne, and little sandwiches of ham and chicken with the crusts cut off. Once everything was gathered in the front hall, Kate oversaw the actual packing with military authority and surgical precision. "Coolers, Large suitcase, small vase, small suitcase. After a good half hour of jostling and rearranging, the trunk was closed. Then came the last two commands, the same every week. My leather bags, would come the cry, which meant grabbing two pouches that looked as though the Pony Express had once carried them, filled with her latest writings, address books, wallet, and current mail. And then, just as we were ready to take off, where's Phyllis? Miss Wilburn, who had taken to wandering, physically and mentally, would be herded into the front seat, where she was given a huge vase of flowers to hold all the way to New York. Kate and I would pile into the back, the leather pouches and food for the ride between us. Sometimes there'd be an additional passenger, which of course complicated the procedure by 20%. All hands still on deck, Dick, his lady friend Virginia, any other Hepburn siblings or nephews, continued to come out front for the 1-2-1-2-3 salute, though over the next few years, the tradition would fade away for lack of enthusiasm. We usually stopped at a vegetable stand, then took the turnpike to New Haven, where I was delivered to my front door on St. Ronan Street. I'd go to bed early on Sunday nights, thoroughly refreshed by the weekend, too exhausted not to get a good night's sleep, and too stuffed to want to eat for several days. Kate and I would speak on the telephone once or twice during the week to confirm our weekend plans. Every few weeks, however, she would say, "We're in a rut. We're like an old married couple. You better spend the weekend in the city." She said there was nothing in the world better than having somebody else's apartment in New York when the owner wasn't around. During the late 80s, the friendship between Kate and Cynthia McFadden intensified. As Cynthia enjoyed a meteoric rise in her career, becoming enough of a star reporter on Court TV to be invited to join the powerful team at ABC News, she often lived upstairs on 49th Street. She and Kate also traveled a great deal together, to Los Angeles or Canada when Kate was working on a television movie, to Boca Grande, Florida for vacations. So it was with mixed emotions for Kate when Cynthia fell in love and agreed to marry a man absolutely besotten with her, Michael Davies, the elegant publisher of the Hartford Courant. Cynthia told Kate that she dreamed one night of being married at Fenwick, and Kate made the dream come true. I can think of no greater sign of Kate's love for her young friend and protege than opening her private sanctuary to Cynthia and her family and friends. All the 49th Street irregulars gathered for the event as well. Phyllis and Nora, of course, and also Tony Harvey, an old friend from Philadelphia named David Eichler, and me, along with Kate's siblings and Kathy Houghton. There was a merry party the night before the wedding at the couple's sprawling new house in Lyme, Connecticut, just across the river. Midday, September 9th, 1989, we all gathered in the little church at Fenwick. A longtime friend and photographer of Kate, John Bryson, was there to take pictures. After the short, sweet ceremony, almost everybody walked over to the Hepburn house. Kate, in a cream-colored jacket worn over a white turtleneck shirt and white pants and white sneakers, rode. We enjoyed a beautiful late-summer garden party under a marquee at the rear of the house. Kate's foot ached that day, but she circulated among all the guests before finding a chair. Even then she hardly sat, as she made a point of standing for each person who approached to say hello or goodbye. When it came time to cut the five-tiered creamy cake, the bride called Kate over to share in the first piece, which she pushed into Kate's face. Everybody laughed, mostly Kate. Kate was obviously happy seeing Cynthia so happy, but she was already starting to miss her company. In truth, they would continue to see almost as much of each other as before she married, but Kate knew that she could no longer be the central person in Cynthia's life. Kate also felt that there was a great imbalance in the relationship, that the groom loved the bride more than she loved him. Kate wondered why it had been necessary to marry him. By 5 that afternoon, all the guests and the help had left. Kate and I were alone, under the tent, killing a bottle of club soda after the day's champagne. She said she thought it was unfair for Cynthia to marry Michael, that Cynthia was more concerned just then with her career than with pleasing a husband, and that that was no way to enter a marriage. The more she talked, the more I felt she was talking about her own marriage to Luddy, and the more she talked, the angrier she got. At last we just sat there, watching the sun pass over the Long Island Sound in silence, until Kate said, "Pig." "Let's go in," I said. putting my arm around her shoulder. She reached up and squeezed my hand tightly. Kate's driver took me to Hartford, where I caught a plane to New York in order to make a connection late that night to London, where I was going to promote my Goldwyn book. I had a few minutes at JFK, during which I called Irene Selznick. As soon as she heard my voice, she said, "Revolting." "I'm sorry," I said, trying to catch up with her mind. "The cake in the face, I know all about it. Absolutely revolting. Do you think she's lost her mind?" Irene pressed me for every detail of the wedding, though she seemed to know most of them already. I flipped through the guest list in my mind to ascertain who had filled her in. To this day, I don't know the identity of her mole, I suspect Nora. But I did know that after almost 60 years of friendship, everything Kate did of late irritated her, and Irene never dealt well with pain. Although I always found her extremely democratic in her thinking, Irene had been raised a princess. She liked, expected even, everything in her life to be special, exclusive. She titled her discreet memoirs, in which she kept her most revealing stories between the lines, "A Private View," and she prided herself on a life full of people and experiences few could match. For her, it wasn't fame or wealth that conferred prestige, so much as uniqueness. Accordingly, it pained her to see Kate becoming increasingly public. One day, Kate got into an argument with a traffic warden on 49th Street over her momentarily double-parked car. When the altercation made the newspapers, complete with pictures, Irene was mortified. Not long after that, Irene was sick in bed, and Kate decided to bring some of Nora's soup to her apartment at the Hotel Pierre. Irene was moved by the gesture, but she reported to me, "She got into the elevator here looking like Raggedy Ann, and the elevator operator wouldn't take her up. She had no idea who this bag lady was, and Kate had to go to the manager to get permission to come up. Kate! I'm talking about Kate, Katharine Hepburn!" Irene was devastated. It was hard enough for her to feel she had lost her friend to a gang of younger people she didn't know, or that Kate forged valiantly on with her career despite her own physical maladies. Irene had come to feel excluded from Kate's life, and she was unwilling to try to be included any longer. She decided Kate was becoming a commoner. More than once that year, Irene talked about her noble friend and suddenly burst into tears. There was one more thing. During her last visit to East 49th Street, Irene discovered a young woman she did not know who had been staying there. At one moment, her eagle eyes witnessed an exchange between the two of them that suggested a level of intimacy she had never allowed herself to believe. "Now everything makes sense," Irene said to me. "Dorothy Arzner, Nancy Hamilton, all those women, Laura Harding, now it all makes sense. A double gaiter. I never believed that relationship with Spence was about sex." "Irene, I think you might be getting carried away," I said. "I sure get the feeling that Spencer Tracy was a pretty sexual animal, and they wouldn't have lasted that long if sex wasn't involved." "In the beginning," she said. "But you can't drink as much as Spence did and maintain a relationship built on sex." "But like most great relationships," I suggested, "shouldn't it become about something more?" Irene granted that was the case with Hepburn and Tracy, but she was disturbed by her new understanding of Kate's sexual nature. "Irene," I said, "you don't know what goes on with all these women. I mean, Kate herself says nobody really knows what goes on between two people when they're alone." "That's my point," Irene replied. "You're too young to have known all those other women, those single women. I knew them. I knew who they were." I said I felt that Kate was simply more comfortable with single people of either sexual persuasion, that she felt she could get closer to individuals with no other attachments, and that while I had told her of a relationship in my life that began about the time she and I met, she almost never wanted to hear about it. "I don't like to think of you living anywhere," Kate said to me shortly after giving me the key to her house. "I like to think that this is your home." Again, sexuality was not really the issue between Kate and Irene. It was the exclusion that troubled Mrs. Selznick, that there had been a dimension of Kate's life that had never been revealed to her, one that Kate could now be sharing with people she had never even heard of. This realization became a turning point in their lives, the moment at which Irene, feeling hurt, began to lose interest in her friend of some 60 years. In 1990, Irene seemed to be suffering physically, but so far as I knew, no doctor could put his finger on a specific problem. Her body ached. "Of course it aches," Kate would say. "She never moves in or out of that goddamned apartment." And her appetite was diminishing. In some ways, she was happier than I had seen her in more than 10 years, largely because, for the first time since I had known her, she was feeling good about the lives of both her sons at the same time. Jeffrey had married a beautiful woman named Barbara, who loves him and looks after him better than he deserves. And not only had Danny married into the Sulzberger family, but Irene observed, "They think he's Cary Grant." Her will, which she amended regularly as long as I knew her, was in order. So it came as a shock to me that summer when I received one of the most unforgettable phone calls of my life, one in which, after a few minutes of pleasantries, Irene said, "I'm calling to say goodbye." "Goodbye, where are you going?" "I said, I'm calling to say goodbye. Goodbye, the big trip." It dawned on me what she was saying, but I couldn't believe it. "Is everything all right?" I asked. Irene said, "Don't I sound all right?" I replied that she sounded better than she had in ages. "That's right," she said. "That's why I'm calling to say goodbye." Irene explained that for the first time in years, she was happy with her life. "Everything's in order," she said, and because she was relatively free of pain, she didn't want to endure the real thing when it came along. "Well, maybe it won't come along," I suggested, and she could go on in her present state for many more years. "I don't want to go on for many more years," she replied. "But don't you want to see your children's lives play out and your grandson? You adore him. And what about your friends? I've just started this book, and I want to be able to share it with you." "Darling," she said, "I do care about your book. So we'll keep talking to each other every few days, and you'll come to see me every few months, and I'll ask about your book, and you'll tell me, and I know how this whole chapter of your life will end. I'm tired of watching things when I know how they'll end." I suggested that she was probably going through a kind of depression, and maybe a little time and perhaps some medication would change her attitude. "Do I sound depressed?" she asked. "I can't remember the last time I felt this good." "So why are you calling then? What can I do?" I asked. She told me that I could just carry on being her friend, as though this call had never happened. She explained that she was calling 5 or 6 people whom she named. Kate was not among them. She said we had become special friends, and she didn't want me to pick up the paper one morning and suddenly read her obituary. "Well, you're smart enough to know that this is a cry for help then," I said. "And I'm going to call somebody. A mutual friend, a doctor, your boys, Kate." "No," she shouted into the phone. "If you discuss this call with anybody, I will never speak to you again." We talked for another 2 hours, and I reluctantly agreed to her terms. But I begged her to discuss the matter with her sons. If she didn't, I argued, she was putting an unfair burden on her friends. She agreed. "So this is really goodbye then?" I asked before hanging up. "No," she said. "Probably late September, but certainly by the first week of October." I was stunned. I thought perhaps a doctor had given her a death sentence of some kind, a recurrence of her cancer maybe. But Irene had said that was not the case, or, I tried to recall, had she merely issued a non-denial denial. So I played by the rules and said nothing to anybody. Our conversations with each other continued without further reference to the phone call, though I did send her missives with small comments that revealed that I had listened to everything she had told me over the years. She replied with grateful notes. On October 11, 1990, during a break at the Yale Library, I picked up my phone messages from Los Angeles, which included an urgent call from John Goldwyn, Samuel Goldwyn's grandson, and Irene Selznick's godson. He told me the news that Irene had been found dead that morning. Wasn't it shocking? Over the next few weeks, I learned of a few others who had received Irene's farewell phone calls. She had discussed the matter with her children, I learned, though they were obviously unable to thwart her plans. She had not called Kate, who probably would have been more supportive of her exit plan than she imagined. Then I learned that Irene died under circumstances even more mysterious than I had imagined. There was apparently no evidence that Irene had committed suicide. I was told that she'd stayed up late that night, fussing with papers and making a few calls. She was found dead in her bed in the morning, with her hands folded over her chest, holding her eyeglasses, and wearing a beatific look. I have since pursued the story of exactly how Irene Selznick died, and the best answer seems to be that she, as only she could do, simply willed it. The memorial service was arranged for November 9th at the Ethel Barrymore Theater. Kate had no intention of attending. I called her the week before and the night before and argued that I thought she would feel better if she went, that Irene had played an important role in her life. "What's the point?" Kate asked. "She's dead. She won't know the difference." "What about Danny and Jeffrey?" I asked. "It would mean a lot to them." There was no arguing about that. I swung by the next day, and her driver took us to the Ethel Barrymore before the doors inside had even opened. Kate barged in, and I followed, and several ushers called out that she couldn't enter yet, as they were still setting up. Hearing the commotion, Danny, who was producing the event, came up the aisle, told the ushers it was all right, and embraced Kate. Her eyes welled up seeing him. He asked us where we wanted to sit, and we selected center orchestra seats. Minutes later, the few hundred others were admitted. All the speakers that afternoon were concise, eloquent, funny, and on the mark, just as Irene would have insisted. She came across as a no-nonsense woman whom everybody found challenging. After quickly escaping to Kate's waiting car, she said, "Don't ever have one of those for me." I said I was sure some tribute was inevitable. "Well, luckily I won't have to be there for it," she added, "and neither should you." I suggested that Irene's service had provided some comfort for everybody there. "Not me," she said. "She's dead, and nothing's going to bring her back. Better if everybody had stayed home and thought about her for a moment, then gone on with their lives. And that's all they should do when I die, and if anybody wants to do more than that, they can rent one of my movies." A few dozen of us, Kate included, went back to Irene's apartment. The rooms were filled with several recognizable faces from an earlier era of show business. They all focused on the foyer when Katharine Hepburn entered. While she spoke to Danny Selznick, I fixed two plates of food, and after a few minutes, Kate was making motions to leave when a short old man made a beeline toward her, calling out, "Will you speak to me?" I could see she didn't recognize him, and I was able to whisper, "Elia Kazan," before he was standing in front of her. "Gadge," she said to a man she had not spoken to in more than 40 years. "That can't be you." He beamed and leaned over to kiss her on the cheek. While they exchanged greetings, I could see another elderly man watching the reunion. Emboldened, he walked over as well and said, "And will you speak to me?" "Of course I will," she said, having no idea who was then pecking at her other cheek. As he spoke to Kazan for a moment, I whispered, "Joe Mankiewicz." "Good God," she said. For the next 2 minutes, everybody was all smiles. Then Kate said she had to leave. I accompanied her to the street. She said she was going home, but that I should go back to the party and come over when it was done. She climbed into the back seat of the waiting car, and before the driver pulled away from the curb at the Pierre 61st Street entrance, she rolled down her window and said, "Do I look as awful as they do?" "God, no, Kate. At least they knew who you were." I returned to the 10th floor. After a few minutes, I slipped away from the living room and retreated to the den where Irene and I had always sat. A guard was posted there, watching over the artwork and personal effects. I went to the little refrigerator and pulled out the bottle of Carrie's Aquavit and poured myself a shot. Then I sat in the chair in front of the Mary Cassatt picture of the little girl and cried. Chapter 9. Always Mademoiselle. "No, I couldn't in all truth say I was surprised by the offer," Kate remembered of that afternoon at the end of 1966. "But honestly, can you imagine me as a fireman's wife?" Stanley Kramer, who had become Hollywood's most socially conscious filmmaker, and who had directed Spencer Tracy 3 times already, visited the Q-Corp guesthouse with a new idea for a movie he was hatching with the screenwriter of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, William Rose. A handsome and alcoholic American expatriate living on the Channel Island of Jersey, Rose was plotting the story of a wealthy British couple whose daughter brings home the man she intends to marry, perfect in every way, except for his being of another race. Sidney Poitier, then the most successful man of color ever to have appeared in motion pictures, had already expressed interest in playing the fiancé, a cultivated professional man, the kind of role model that had not appeared in a mainstream film. With that piece in place, Kramer set about casting the co-stars. A devoted friend and fan of Spencer Tracy, Kramer had suddenly thought this film might provide a glorious last hurrah for the ailing actor. By transplanting the story from its English locale to American soil, Tracy could easily play a retired, middle-class Irish-American, a former cop or fireman. Having broached the idea to Tracy without being brushed off, Kramer continued to spin his gears. If indeed this was likely to be Spencer Tracy's last appearance in motion pictures, in a love story at that, he asked himself what would be more moving than casting him opposite his romantic partner of 25 years. By the time Kramer had arrived at the cottage, the story had shifted even further. Once I heard Stanley describe the setup, and he was suggesting that the fireman be in a more elevated position, Kate recalled, I knew that he was thinking of me to play the wife. The three kicked around several possibilities that day. Tracy, who had for decades played the conscience in so many dramas, the all-American voice of truth and justice, would be wasted playing a priest in this romantic story, and he'd already portrayed a judge for Kramer. They discussed his being a newspaper publisher, a man who had long been a liberal voice of reason, a man who stood for social justice, who suddenly balked when the ultimate test of his liberalism landed on his own doorstep. He would find himself coming up against his wife, who would be speaking from the heart, a sensible woman who would be the voice of romance. Kate had mixed feelings about the project. She thought it sounded like a wonderful film, with something important to say, and she was eager to do it. For the first time, however, she worried that Tracy was not physically able to complete the job. Even in the world of studio doctors, who routinely signed off on major health risks so that movies could get made, Spencer Tracy had become uninsurable. Knowing that, Kramer made two unusual promises to the actor. He said he would arrange the entire shooting schedule around Tracy, so that he would only have to shoot a few hours a day, and in the morning at that, when he was at his best. Furthermore, he said that if Hepburn and Tracy would not make this movie, neither would he. Columbia Studios agreed to finance the picture only if Hepburn would put her $250,000 salary in escrow, along with the director's $500,000, until the completion of principal photography. That would provide enough insurance to reshoot with another actor should that eventuality arise. Kramer put his money where his mouth was, an act of faith and friendship that Hepburn never forgot. All of Stanley's movies came straight from the heart, she said. There are damn few like him. He retreated to New Jersey with writer Rose, who knocked out the script of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in a matter of weeks. In some ways, the material might have been better suited as a play. A handful of characters, the young lovers, their respective sets of parents, and a priest and maid for some comic relief, converge upon a single set, the San Francisco home of Matt and Christina Drayton, where they deliver speeches that argue all sides of the issue of the impending interracial marriage. But knowing they had Tracy and Hepburn, with at least one of them in a valedictory role, gave Rose and Kramer not only the voices to work with, but also years of cinematic history. Unlike Garbo and Gilbert, Myrna Loy and William Powell, Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, even Abbott and Costello, Tracy and Hepburn had matured as a couple. Over a generation, the public had watched them encounter a number of different situations together, always a little ahead of their times. Paradoxically, this unmarried twosome had become the symbol of the all-American couple, exemplars of family values and even more, of human values. Kate told me years later that while working on his script, Willie Rose said he'd often ask himself, now what would Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn say here? Not the real Spence and the real me, but the images everybody knew. Queer, isn't it? As a result, the entire film gave audiences the feeling that they were eavesdropping, listening in on relatives who had long been part of their collective consciences. The conceit was further enhanced by the actress who debuted in the film as their daughter, Katharine Houghton. The daughter of Kate's sister Marion and a stunning literary graduate of Sarah Lawrence College, Kathy burst onto the screen, displaying a lot of her aunt's zealous personality. Naturally, she looked enough like her to give rise to the rumor that she was, in truth, Tracy and Hepburn's love child, and that Kate's sister had simply been their cover. Now that's one I haven't heard, Kate said of the canard when I mentioned it to her. Too bad so many people are alive who remember when Marion was pregnant. Everybody's anxiety over Tracy's health only fostered greater efficiency on the set of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. But it was a nervous-making shoot for Hepburn, who had to perform double duty, always looking after him and performing a considerably challenging role herself. While the two actors had always stuck around for each other in the past, feeding lines for the other's close-ups, most shots of Hepburn alone were delivered to the script supervisor, thus allowing Tracy to go home early each day as promised. I shouldn't say most movie sets, but certainly on a lot of movie sets you develop a sense of family, Kate recalled. And she added she couldn't remember that feeling ever being so strong as it was on the set of this picture. Tracy and Hepburn had long approached their work differently. He had a phenomenal memory, could read a script, absorb the lines, look over a scene the night before it was shot, and was usually word-perfect on his first take. She liked to study a script, learning not only all her lines before production, but most everybody else's as well. She considered every possible reading she could give, and was known to pass along advice to other actors as to how they might deliver their lines as well. In the past, when she had suggested they rehearse together, Tracy generally dismissed the notion by saying, "I'm saving it for the set." On Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, however, Tracy asked Hepburn to run lines with him every night. He felt he owed as much to his director for putting his salary on the line. He felt he owed Kate even more for having put her career on ice for 5 years. He seemed eager to make this picture especially good, if only to help get her career back on track. So it was disconcerting for the actors to discover that for the first time, he was having trouble remembering his lines. The climax of the film was Spencer Tracy's delivery of its message, a kind of verdict. After starting out as the leading opponent to his daughter's marriage, and listening to each character articulate his or her position, he takes exception to a comment made by the mother of Sidney Poitier's character, played by Bea Richards. She avers that he has become an old man who has forgotten what it is to love. That spurs him to render his ultimate opinion that, in the final analysis, it doesn't matter what we think. The only thing that matters is what they feel, and how much they feel for each other. And if it's half of what we felt, he says, looking toward Hepburn, her eyes brimming with tears, that's everything. It was a flawless performance, and there was not a dry eye on the set. Everybody knew that Spencer Tracy was a great actor, but that day, they felt he wasn't acting. On May 26, 1967, Tracy shot his final scene and went home. Kate thanked the cast and crew for all their cooperation. Hepburn had been residing full-time in the Q Corps guest cottage on St. Ives, though she continued to rent the Barrymore Aviary a few minutes away on Tower Grove Drive. Phyllis spent her nights there. Kate generally sat up late with Tracy in the bedroom on St. Ives until he dozed off. Then she repaired to the maid's room off the kitchen. A buzzer sat on his bedstand, and she carried the bell attached to a long wire wherever she went in the house. Day and night, she monitored his movements, as always, anticipating his needs. Before retiring, she'd put a big kettle of water on the stove, which she kept simmering all night so that he could instantly prepare a cup of tea if he couldn't sleep. At 3 o'clock in the morning of June 10th, 1967, Kate heard Tracy come out of the bedroom and into the kitchen. She was getting out of bed to join him when she heard a teacup smash against the floor, and then a thud. By the time she reached him, Spencer Tracy was dead of a heart attack. While he had been slowly dying over the last few years, she found immediate comfort in the fact that the death itself had come so swiftly. Hepburn immediately summoned Phyllis, George Cukor, the couple who lived on the grounds, and Howard Strickling, the MGM publicity chief, who had decades of experience dealing with the press at the death scenes of Hollywood stars. She was packing up her personal belongings and removing them from the premises when she suddenly came to her senses. This was my house, too, she realized, and I had lived with this man for most of my adult life. She returned to the house and called Louise Tracy, their children, and Tracy's brother. It seemed the least awkward thing to do, Kate explained to me. To have done otherwise would have required a series of lies and would have served nobody. Over the next few hours, she did her best to stay out of the way, to let the Tracy family have their final moments of bereavement, thus depriving herself of that same moment of closure. It was all like a bad dream, Kate recalled more than 20 years later, a real nightmare. It reached its most surreal when the morticians asked how the body should be dressed. Kate had pulled out an old jacket and some trousers, but Louise Tracy took umbrage at not being able to select the clothes herself. In that moment, Kate snapped. "Oh, Louise," she said, "what difference does it make?" By 6 o'clock, a doctor had examined the deceased, and the undertaking firm of Cunningham and Walsh had taken him away. The press would arrive midday, when they were told that Mr. Tracy's friends, Miss Hepburn and Mr. Cukor, had come down to the cottage at 11 that morning. For 3 evenings, the mortuary received mourners. Kate showed up each night after hours. One night, she placed an oil painting she had done of some flowers into the casket. The next night, she learned that the casket had been sealed at the family's request. She presumed her painting remained with him. Upon Tracy's death, Hepburn behaved rather as she had during his lifetime, remaining unseen in public with the man she loved. Early on the morning of the funeral, Kate and Phyllis drove to the mortuary and helped place Spencer Tracy's coffin into the hearse. Then, from a respectable distance, they followed the parade of black cars to the Immaculate Heart of Mary Church in Hollywood. When they got close enough to see that a crowd had formed, they turned around and headed for home. "Goodbye, friend," said Kate. After the funeral, a handful of Tracy's closest friends, those intimate enough to have been part of his actual domestic life, stopped by the house on St. Ives. Hepburn greeted Garson Kanin and Ruth Gordon, writer Chester Erskine and his wife Sally, director Jean Nicolesco and his wife Dusty. Hepburn seemed to be in complete control of her emotions. "I wasn't really putting up a brave front," she later said. "I was just in a complete daze." It wasn't until the Negalescos left, and Jean made a comment about how angry he was that Spencer had left them, that Kate collapsed into his arms and sobbed. One night, some weeks later, Kate told me, she telephoned Mrs. Tracy. Thinking she might be of some help with the children, she said, "You know, Louise, you and I can be friends. You knew Spencer at the beginning. I knew him at the end. Or we can just go on pretending." "Oh, yes," Louise said. "But you see, I thought you were only a rumor." Kate never got over this story. "A rumor," she said to me. "Can you imagine? 30 years her husband isn't there, and she thinks I'm a rumor." For a minute or two, Kate tried to imagine what could possibly have been in Louise Tracy's mind, what hoops of denial she must have jumped through to believe that. I suggested to Kate that Louise Tracy knew the score all along and simply said what she had to get her goat. "But why would she want to do that?" Kate asked in a state of agitation. "Exactly," I said. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner opened the following year and became the most successful picture at the box office that either Tracy or Hepburn had ever appeared in, together or apart. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Actress. William Rose won an Oscar for his screenplay. The late Spencer Tracy was up against Warren Beatty for Bonnie and Clyde, Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke, and Rod Steiger for In the Heat of the Night. The latter won. Hepburn's competition was not quite as stiff. Anne Bancroft for The Graduate, Faye Dunaway for Bonnie and Clyde, Dame Edith Evans for The Whisperers, and Audrey Hepburn for Wait Until Dark. With this, her 10th nomination, Hepburn won her second Oscar, 34 years after her first. "I felt that was the Hollywood community's way of honoring Spence," Kate said years later, with undue modesty. There's no denying that sentiment played heavily into the voting that year, but if the Academy was honoring a life and not that particular performance, this was probably more the Academy's way of applauding Hepburn's return to the public arena. By the time her Oscar was presented, as before, in absentia, she had already completed work on another movie and was in the middle of filming yet another. F. Scott Fitzgerald once commented that in American lives there were no second acts. Had he enjoyed a normal lifespan, he would have been able to see the curtain go up on the fourth act of the life of one of his favorite actresses, Katharine Hepburn, then 60 years of age. Kate recuperated from her loss on Martha's Vineyard as the guest of the Kanins. Long swims, long drives, and long talks contributed to her recovery. But as always with Hepburn, it was work, not recreation, that brought her back to life. That summer, the arrival of a screenplay called The Lion in Winter spurred her into action. James Goldman had adapted his own successful play, the story of the marriage of Henry II of England and his imprisoned wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is sprung for the Christmas holidays in 1183. During the course of the play, they argue the question of succession, a decision that will affect nations on both sides of the Channel. Peter O'Toole, who had played Henry II in Becket, would wear the same crown once more. "What was fascinating about the play," Kate said, "was its modernness. This wasn't about pomp and circumstance, but about a family, a wife trying to protect her dignity and a mother protecting her children." She grew even more excited about the project after seeing a film made by the director O'Toole was favoring, Dutchman, which presented a harsh look at urban life, with a woman stabbing a black man on a New York subway train. It hardly seemed an appropriate screen test for a film about 12th century European royalty, but Kate found director Anthony Harvey's work absolutely riveting. It grabbed you by the throat, exactly the approach that our material needed. Not that glossy old MGM stuff, but cold people living in cold castles. Furthermore, Harvey, an Englishman then in his mid-30s, had been a film editor, for Stanley Kubrick no less, on Lolita and Dr. Strangelove, and Hepburn had long been partial toward the profession. Similar to what she had said about David Lean, Kate reminded me that nobody has the same love affair with film that cutters do. It's a tactile medium for them. She felt an instant rapport with the director, and they became great friends for the rest of Kate's life. Nobody championed him more than she, and in her final years, nobody cared for her more than he. The company, which included a young Anthony Hopkins as her son Richard, soon to be the Lionhearted, and an even younger Timothy Dalton as King Philip of France, rehearsed for 2 weeks in the Haymarket Theatre in London. Then they all moved to Dublin to shoot interior scenes and to Fontvieille, a small village in the south of France, where they filmed in an old abbey. Hepburn admired everyone in the cast. O'Toole was wild and rambunctious, sometimes utterly impossible, a real Irishman, Kate said. Too much charm and too much liquor, but I was used to that. And what an actor! Great voice, great performance, great fun. His great vigor, she suggested, helped restore her vitality. Years later, she would take pride in the deserved success of Hopkins, and when Dalton was hired to play James Bond, she bragged that she knew him when. The film was another triumph for Hepburn, with the public and with the industry. Again, her film was nominated in all the major categories, Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, and Screenplay. Again, the screenwriter won, and so did Hepburn. This third victory was unprecedented. So was the fact that there was a tie that year, with Hepburn sharing Best Actress honors with 26-year-old Barbara Streisand, who had debuted in Funny Girl. After saying, "Hello, gorgeous," to her gleaming trophy, Streisand said what an honor it was to be in the same company as Hepburn, whose award was accepted by Tony Harvey. By then, Hepburn had left one locale in southern France for another, this time to appear in a production of The Madwoman of Chaillot. When she'd signed on to appear in this film version of Jean Giraudoux's play, John Huston was meant to direct. By the time shooting began, however, Brian Forbes had replaced him. "John was no fool," Kate said, of his abandoning this allegory, in which a quixotic noblewoman, the Countess Aurelia, takes on the greedy capitalists of the world. She holds a mock trial and lures all the villains into a bottomless pit by telling them of an oil reserve beneath her house. "The big problem," Kate said, "is that material like this plays better on a stage than on a screen, which requires something more literal. I mean, you have to photograph something, and I think it's difficult for a movie audience to accept an entire film that is so abstract and stylized." Eli Landau, the producer of Long Day's Journey into Night, produced this picture as well, hiring a charm bracelet of international stars, including Charles Boyer, Claude Dauphin, Oscar Homolka, Yul Brynner, Donald Pleasence, and Danny Kaye. The Countess Aurelia's conspirators were played by Edith Evans, Margaret Leighton, and Julieta Messina. "I think the real problem with the picture," Kate said, "is that none of us ever really figured out how to play our parts, how to speak that dialogue, which was terribly artificial. The old girls, we all started impersonating Edith Evans, who really was terribly amusing. But I don't think she knew what she was doing any more than we did. It was really quite hopeless." It was ultimately difficult for an audience, to say nothing of the star herself, to accept Katharine Hepburn as somebody who had truly lost her mind. She ultimately came across as more eccentric than mad. Undaunted, Hepburn found that work begat more work, and her resurgence inspired her to new challenges. In 1969, she agreed to return to the stage after close to a decade's absence, in a genre she had never attempted. Alan J. Lerner had been at work for a year on a musical based loosely on the life of Gabrielle Coco Chanel, the legendary clothes designer, and he wanted Hepburn, also a woman of style, stature, and staying power, to assume the title role. "Now, I'm sure I saw Ethel Merman in something, and I adored My Fair Lady," Kate recalled, though it turned out to be the Q-Corp-directed film version of the Lerner and Lowe classic that she recollected. "But I honestly don't remember ever sitting through a Broadway musical. I certainly never thought I could sing my way through one." Hepburn herself admitted that after a lifetime in the theater, she never learned to vocalize properly, and the only tunes she felt comfortable carrying were hymns. "But I can be loud," she said, "and I figured if Rex Harrison could star in a musical, so could I." She worked up a few songs with musical arranger and vocal coach Roger Edens, which she tried out one night at Irene Selznick's before the guests of a small dinner party, which included Alan Lerner and Frederick Brisson, the play's producer and husband of Rosalind Russell. After bellowing a captivating rendition of Miss Otis Regrets, everybody seemed convinced that she had enough equipment to carry a musical. What she lacked in euphony, she made up for in guts. Ultimately, she found both the challenge and Alan J. Lerner, a man of extraordinary wit and intelligence, irresistible. Coco proved to be the most arduous production of Hepburn's career, a constant uphill battle. She continued her voice lesson 6 days a week. "I'm not sure I ever really learned to sing," Kate admitted, "but I acted well enough to give the impression that I was singing." The lyrics of Coco were among the cleverest Lerner ever wrote, but neither they nor the star were helped much by the music of André Previn, mostly forgettable tunes, some of which sounded like remnants of Gigi. Then the show's director, Michael Benthal, who had guided Hepburn in The Millionaires, began to stumble. When he proved unable to tackle all the elements of the musical, which included not only a complicated revolving set, but also several characters out of Coco's past appearing on large screens in film segments, he was sidelined. The choreographer, the young Michael Bennett, stepped in and assumed directorial duties as well. Bold and brash and full of his own ideas, he clashed constantly with Lerner and the star, both of whom he felt had somehow turned the show from the life of Chanel into that of Katharine Hepburn, an independent female artist who gets through life by remaining always Mademoiselle. In fact, that was the title of the big finale, and several of its sentiments came straight from Hepburn's mouth. One night, while she was getting extremely frustrated with the entire production, Kate threw her hands up at dinner and said to Lerner, "Who the devil cares what a woman wears?" He said, "Kate, that's a good lyric," and used it. In the same number, he also adopted one of Hepburn's firmest beliefs about character, that actions define a person, that, as Lerner lyricized it, one is as one does. With the exception of George Rose, who played Coco's friend and manager Louis Greff, Hepburn felt the cast was pretty mediocre. "With all the actors in New York," she said, "it always amazes me how difficult it is to find a few with real talent." During one number, Bennett staged a routine in which a dancer had to stand in front of Hepburn and perform a series of fan kicks, first swinging his right leg over her head, then the left. "I'm sure Michael kept hoping the man would miss one night and kick me right in the face," Kate said. Everybody lived in constant fear that the set wouldn't revolve properly, and on more than one occasion it didn't. The audiences on those nights got perhaps the best show of all, as Hepburn would step center stage and regale the crowd with show business anecdotes until the machinery was functioning again. Once the show opened, the week before Christmas 1969, none of the problems seemed to matter. For 8 months, fans came steadily to see this sumptuous showcase for Katharine Hepburn with its Cecil Beaton sets and costumes. While some critics quibbled over her warbling or quarreled over the writing, everybody succumbed to the power and energy the trim Chanel-tailored sextagenarian exuded on the stage of the Mark Hellinger Theater 8 times a week. It remained a strained production, for which Hepburn shouldered much of the responsibility. "How couldn't it be tense?" Kate asked. "I was nervous about every performance, wondering what the hell I was doing out there." She left Coco in August 1970 and was replaced by Danielle Dario, who performed admirably. But the production closed shortly thereafter. Hepburn recorded the cast album and resurrected the show on the road before sold-out standing ovations. Through the 1970s, Katharine Hepburn remained in perpetual motion, tackling one project after another. Work remained the best antidote against grief. In fact, she refused far more offers than she accepted, agreeing only to those that provided the opportunity to work with unique talent or special material. Never having performed Greek tragedy, she went to Spain at the end of 1970 to appear in a film version of Euripides' Trojan Women. Michael Kekoyanis, who had directed Zorba the Greek, had also enticed Vanessa Redgrave to co-star. Kate considered her the most accomplished actress of her generation, a thrill to look at and to listen to. Years later, in fact, there was talk of turning Hepburn's memoir about the making of the African Queen into a film, which didn't excite her until she learned that Redgrave might play her. "I don't know who else could possibly do it," she said. Kate worked next on two projects that she ultimately abandoned. She was meant to star in a film version of Graham Greene's Travels with My Aunt, which George Cukor was directing. After receiving no satisfaction from several different versions of the script, Hepburn took to rewriting it herself. Shortly before shooting was to begin, the studio announced its displeasure with her version and that they were going back to earlier drafts of the script. "When I said I had no interest in any of the earlier drafts," Kate recalled, "they said thank you very much." She was replaced by Maggie Smith in what proved to be an unsatisfying production released in 1972. And at the height of their friendship, Kate worked for years with Irene Selznick on a project called Martha, based on a series of books by Marjorie Sharp about a young artist. Irene intended to produce the film with Kate directing. The project was subsequently aborted, not because I didn't think I could direct, and not because I didn't think Irene could produce a movie. I think it's simply because I was afraid we'd kill each other. Then producer Eli Landau approached her for the third time, on this occasion touting something called the American Film Theater. He was producing cinematic versions of important dramas, which would play on television and have theatrical film distribution. The play in question was Edward Albee's A Delicate Balance, a family drama about a seemingly complacent older couple in suburban Connecticut whose lives are suddenly thrown off kilter by the unexpected arrival of their best friends. This visit becomes a strange incursion, compelling the characters to examine the debts and deceptions in their lives. "I'll be honest with you," Kate divulged. "I knew that Albee was considered the great white hope of the American theater, but I had absolutely no idea what that play was about." Surrounded by an elite corps of actors, which included Paul Scofield and Joseph Cotten, and directed by Tony Richardson, a highly intelligent and fussy British expatriate, Hepburn came to appreciate the point of the play. "I think it's about self-protection," she said, "how our homes become our domains, and how we want to protect that from outsiders. And we even come to see that this marriage is really made up of two people trying to protect themselves from each other. He's a stuffed shirt, she's a bossy old thing, and that's the only way they can save themselves. At least that's what I think. I must tell you, for the first time in my life, I had no idea what I was saying. Maybe that tells you how good the dialogue in that play is." Several people had told her the play was funny, but Kate confessed, "I never really saw a grain of humor in it." Then producer David Susskind, who had been attempting for years to mount a television production of The Glass Menagerie, asked Kate to play the mother. She was loath to accept the offer. Having starred in motion pictures for 40 years, she had a knee-jerk reaction against a work made directly for television. She also had Lorette Taylor's performance as Amanda Wingfield ingrained in her memory. Agreeing to the project meant she would get to work with Anthony Harvey again, which pleased her enormously. But what ultimately convinced her to take the part was the opportunity for her niece, Kathy Houghton, to play her daughter once again, this time the crippled Laura. Hepburn signed on, only to learn that Kathy Houghton was not interested in playing the role. "She would have been perfect," Kate said. "It's a great part for her." But Kathy had other acting plans at the time, as well as writing aspirations. Kate never really appreciated that it might be difficult for her niece to perform in her shadow. While Hepburn was not ideally cast as the Southern mother, who endlessly recalls her days as an alluring belle, she brought all the requisite power to the role, which she delivered with grace and intelligence. Tony Harvey directed a strong supporting cast, Sam Waterston, Michael Moriarty, and Joanna Miles. The program became one of the great television events of 1973, commanding huge ratings. Its success opened Hepburn's mind to the possibilities of future work in the medium. Then Hepburn's friend George Cukor, in his mid-70s, was offered an elegant script by James Costigan for television. Love Among the Ruins was an Edwardian story of an elderly actress who turns to a former beau to defend her against a younger man suing for breach of promise. Cukor thought it would be ideal for Hepburn and Laurence Olivier. Hepburn agreed and made a crucial suggestion to the director. "Look," she said, "we both know Larry, and he will do this project only if you go to him first. Then suggest several other actresses until he mentions my name. Then you can say, 'Larry, if I knew you were doing this play, I'm sure I could get Kate.'" Olivier bought Cukor's act. Hepburn enjoyed working with Olivier, though she was still recuperating from a hip replacement operation at the time. She thought he was a first-rate actor, but she felt compelled to add that she thought he was a second-rate person. More than finding him a posturing egomaniac, she based her judgment largely on his treatment of his former wife, Vivian Lee, a talented though troubled woman with whom Kate had been friendly. "Larry always wanted to be a big movie star," Kate said, "and while he was considered the greatest actor on the stage, he was never in the first rank as a star in the movies. Then Vivian comes along and gets Scarlett O'Hara, wins the Academy Award, biggest picture ever made. Suddenly Larry says, 'Oh, darling, we really must get you out of Hollywood now. Let's go off and do Shakespeare together.' Now Vivian could do anything, but he was clearly trying to keep her in her place, which was billed beneath him. Then a few years pass, and Vivian returns to make Streetcar, and she's brilliant, wins the Academy Award, most talked about movie of the year, and suddenly Larry says, 'Oh, darling, we really must get you out of Hollywood now. Let's go off and do Shakespeare together.' Small man. Giant actor. Very small man." Love Among the Ruins was a great success, collecting rave notices, big ratings, and Emmy Awards for the director and his two stars. Hepburn next teamed with John Wayne. She had not worked with him before, and she hadn't played opposite an actor who seemed so different from her since she and Humphrey Bogart navigated the Congo River. In many ways, this picture, Rooster Cogburn, was a carbon copy of The African Queen. A Bible-toting minister's daughter ends up on a journey with an aging marshal who is after a gang of bad guys. The title hero was, in fact, the same character Wayne had played in True Grit. There wasn't much more to this movie than the two legends firing stereotypical dialogue at each other, but both stars had a good time making it. Coming from two different political camps, these rugged old-timers simply avoided controversial subjects and chose to enjoy each other's company. Said Kate, "I can honestly say I never met a man who worked harder or played harder than Duke. He was a total straight shooter, decent and fun, just a natural. We were up in the Cascades, and some days we got on our horses and rode all day. Great fun. Big man. Small backside." The stunt casting alone was reason enough for some people to see the film, though not many. In 1976, Hepburn agreed to a 3-month run of a play called A Matter of Gravity by her friend Enid Bagnold. This was a lighter version of her hit play The Chalk Garden, a look at several generations in a big English country house. In London, Edith Evans had played the dotty matriarch in the decaying home. Bagnold was only too happy to alter the part to suit the grande dame of the American theater. In retrospect, one of the play's greatest distinctions was its appearance of Christopher Reeve as her grandson in one of his first roles. Kate took a shine to the handsome young actor. So the day I heard that Reeve had been paralyzed in a near-fatal accident, I called Kate to give her the news. "Part of me thinks you'll say he'd be better off dead." "Hmm," Kate said, passively agreeing. Then she added, "But I don't think so. He's strong. Strong body, strong spirit. He's got family he loves. He's got guts. And unlike a lot of actors, he's got a brain." Before taking A Matter of Gravity on a successful nationwide tour, Hepburn appeared in an odd, forgotten little movie called Ollie Ollie Oxenfree, in which she played the owner of a junkyard who helps two children repair a hot air balloon. All I really remember about it, Kate said, only 5 years after making it, is that I got to ride in the balloon. And one night,